Friends, welcome to episode 3 of the Decentralized Health Podcast. Today's guest is Danielle Danny Hamilton. She's a quantum and circadian nutritionist and renowned blood sugar expert specializing in using a personalized circadian and quantum approach to optimizing metabolic health. Her own personal journey in this specialized field was fueled by her personal battles with PCOS, hypoglycemia, acne, and weight loss resistance, which she successfully reversed after learning that blood sugar issues and metabolic issues were at the root. After working with clients for several years and helping hundreds reverse their metabolic issues like insulin resistance, there were others who just continued to struggle despite doing everything right. Encouraged to dig deeper, Danny turned to nature for answers and discovered the incredible power of light, water, and magnetism to help optimize not only metabolic health, but every aspect of health. Lit up by the sun's healing powers, she now uses a circadian and quantum approach as a foundation for helping her clients heal. Danny is on a mission to help the world get back to nature, to heal their blood sugar, up-level their energy, and feel great. She is the host of the Top 50 Nutrition podcast, Light Up Your Metabolism. She's also the creator of the transformative Blood Sugar Mastery Program. Ladies and gentlemen, this is going to be an absolute banger. Please welcome Danielle Danny Hamilton.
So the sun by itself it's not inherently trying to give you skin cancer or any kind of cancer. It's actually anti-cancer because of all these effects that we just mentioned. And it's how we get vitamin D and how we modulate our immune system and getting all this amazing infrared and supporting our mitochondria and building exclusion zone water, supporting our negative charge. Because when we're out there, we're probably grounding too, right? We're getting sun and we're grounding. And so we're building this beautiful exclusion zone around ourselves. And that is helping us not get cancer.
Danielle Danny Hamilton, welcome to the Decentralized Health Podcast. It is now my turn to host you as you lovingly hosted me. How are you, my darling?
I'm doing so well. I love when you say that. So thanks, Mark. Happy to be here. Happy to be in your presence.
My pleasure. And you're looking lovely as always. Change the hair. It's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful.
And positive vibes going on.
The way that you're positioned with that sun ray coming out from behind you as well. It's so becoming. It's lovely.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Absolutely lovely. So as I say, welcome to the Decentralized Health Podcast. And today we're here to share your story, how you went from that centralized approach into that decentralized approach, and then how you then obviously apply that in your practice with your clients. So please introduce yourself to the world. Who are you? What do you do? Where'd you come from? All that jazz.
Yeah, so I guess my health journey and the journey into a more decentralized approach kind of starts in childhood. I learned your story, Mark, and your antibiotic use definitely takes the cake over mine. But I also grew up eating processed foods, ultra processed foods, lots of sweet ones. I liked, the cereals, the oatmeals, the Eggo waffles, toaster strudels. I don't know if you guys have those over in the UK.
An Eggo waffle?
Yeah, it's like a freezer waffle. And then I put like light syrup on it because it was, the 90s and heaven forbid anything was not light. Heaven forbid anything had a drop of fat in it. You know, we used Pam, which is like a canola oil spray.
I remember that.
Spritz the pan real quick. So we didn't get a lot of fat, So growing up on this ultra processed foods diet, I not surprisingly had many ear infections and strep throat and required a lot of antibiotics and colds and flus and all that. But as I got older, my health kind of kept getting worse. So in my senior year of high school, I got strep throat 6 times and unfortunately got my tonsils out. And then the next year I was in college or university, as you all say. And I developed seasonal allergies. I started to get exercise induced asthma. And then I moved to Miami, Florida, where you're in the tropics and the season for allergies is all year round. And so I was allergic to so many things. I was allergic to palm trees. It felt like a cruel joke. And I felt like I needed to be in a bubble because inside, what I didn't realize at the time was there was a lot of mold. And so I was just, my allergies and asthma were like off the charts. And I was getting allergy shots and was also on multiple medications, multiple inhalers. I had chronic sinus infections, and I was so allergic to so many things. They gave me 3 shots to try to like calm my immune system down. And then that worked for a little bit. And then I started to develop more allergies. And so it was because I wasn't healing the root cause, and, you know, my gut was a mess, and I was, I guess, still in this mold, and I was allergic to more things. So I was giving, I got 5 shots at a time because I was just so allergic to so many things.
Jeez.
And it was just like, what is happening? You know, I'd ask all the centralized doctors, like, why do you think this could be happening? And their answers were, guess it's just bad luck or bad genetics. And it just felt so disempowering because it was like constantly at the pharmacy filling medications and constantly feeling uncomfortable. So whether it felt like I woke up and an elephant was sitting on my chest, or whether my eyes were itchy, or my throat was itchy, or it was dry, or I had to blow my nose. I mean, it's allergies. It's like, oh, okay, allergies. No, allergies are so annoying. They're so uncomfortable. I just, you want to like rip your throat out or rip your eyes out. I mean, at least I did. And so that was, it was really uncomfortable. And so at work, I was working as a speech therapist at the time, and someone mentioned something about this thing called the paleo diet and eat like our ancestors. And just something about that just resonated with me enough for me to get Rob Wolf's book, The Paleo Diet Solution. And I read that book, and I just, I mean, my life was forever changed because of that book. I was like, oh my God, we've been lied to, you know, we shouldn't minimize salt. We should embrace salt. We shouldn't fear the fat and throw out the egg yolks. We should eat those. And it was just like everything that I had been taught was wrong. And I was always a person who, I ate those processed breakfast foods when I was a kid. But once I started to know things, I was like, well, I'm going to get 100 calorie packs and do whole wheat bread and, you know, granola bars and all these things because that's healthier. And it was, I was trying to be healthy and thin my whole life, yet I was unable to because I was following the wrong advice. And so I felt so wronged, and I felt so enraged because at the nursing home, people were suffering. Like everyone around me was just really suffering with their health. And you'd see so much dementia and Alzheimer's and diabetes, which I didn't really know how that was affecting people, but I saw a lot of it. And it was just people were incapacitated, and it was really devastating to watch. And then as a speech therapist, I started working with kids, and I was like, oh my gosh, here's the same stuff, like all this nutrition advice that we're giving the general public. These kids on the spectrum walk in and they're holding a Happy Meal, and then they proceed to have a tantrum. You know, just one example could, or it could be a kid not on the spectrum who just, you know, eating McDonald's and then having a tantrum and not being able to pay attention. And so I started just really learning so much about nutrition and how it affects our bodies. And so when I implemented the paleo diet, all of my symptoms, everything got better. Like it was like magic. I got to stop giving myself the allergy shots. I didn't have to take any more inhalers. I got off all my medications. I never had another sinus infection. And so I wanted to shout from the rooftops. I'm like, oh my God, we've been lied to. This is amazing. Like, you know, and so I was really bought into the nutrition piece. And so, as I said, I was living in Miami, Florida at the time. And then I, well, let me finish that little story with the kids on the, with the nutrition piece. So I was also seeing, just like paralleling, like how important nutrition was when I was a speech therapist, I also started to learn about nutrition for kids on the spectrum with ADHD, with learning disabilities. So all sorts of the, you know, the kids that would come into my office. Yeah. And I was starting to learn how important, you know, fat soluble vitamins are for them, and omega-3s, and just different nutritional deficiencies and stuff like that. And there was a kid who, like, I wasn't allowed to talk about this stuff, but I had very good rapport with the parents. And so I would always ask, especially with kids on the spectrum, I would ask, is there a food that your child is very obsessed with? And this one particular case, the mom was like, yeah, his milk bottle, he gets powdered milk. I don't know why powdered, but that's what he got. And when he came into my office, He was running back and forth in the room, hysterical laughing the whole time, turning on and off the lights. And I was pulling out every trick in the book, bubbles and songs and toys and all the things to get him to look at me, to get him to literally know I was in the room. And he was just like laughing, which, by the way, is a symptom of yeast and candida overgrowth, because the laughter is often because of the alcohol byproducts. That's what I learned. I don't know. I mean, a long time ago, but really interesting. And so he did not even, I don't think it was in his awareness that I was in the room. I'm going to just put it like that. So I asked the mom, what does he have? And he has this powdered milk bottle. And I go, I wonder what would happen if he didn't get it for the next, you know, if the store ran out of it and he just had to have water, something. So she took him off of this bottle and he came back in 2 weeks and sat on the floor with me for 25 minutes, played with me, looking at me, joint attention. And I was like, I'm in the wrong profession. Like, I'm just like, it's not that we don't need speech therapy, but that would have taken 4 years of speech therapy. And it took 2 weeks to like, and so I was just like, oh my gosh, nutrition is so powerful. So I was just so, you know, I thought it was so important, and I still do, but it was really cool to see how this was affecting people all across the lifespan. So anyway, I was in Miami, Florida. I was flying high on the paleo train. I was, you know, really happy with all the improvements that I had to my health. And then I moved to New York, followed an ex there. And I'm originally from New York, so it wasn't that big of a shock, but it was definitely, you know, being in the city and it was getting cold and a really hard winter. And all of a sudden I started to, you know, I was eating this whole foods, paleo diet, very high quality foods. And I started to put on weight, and then I started to have a resurgence of acne. I'd always had acne, always struggled with it on and off, but it was like really bad this time. It was like on my cheeks, all over my foreheads. I'm like, good thing I have bangs. And I was, and then my menstrual cycle started to become pretty irregular. And then I didn't get it, and I wasn't getting it, and I wasn't getting it. And 6 months passed and I didn't get it. And then it was 3 months, and I was like, what is happening to me? And the other thing was, I was always, my mom always called me a rooster. She's like, you're like a rooster. You always wake up early. She's from New York. And so I was always up with the sun. I was always up early. That was just in my nature. And I started sleeping really late when I was in New York. Like, I would wake up at like 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock and have my best sleep somewhere in the morning, like 9 or 10. And I was like, this is so weird. This isn't like me, but I was just so tired all the time and I couldn't figure out what was happening to me. So of course I went to the internet and I was like, it really looks like I have PCOS, the polycystic ovarian syndrome. So the weight gain, the acne, the irregular menstrual cycles. And luckily I didn't have the symptoms where you get the hair growth on the face or the male pattern baldness type starting to happen. But I definitely was like, I have this. And so I started to look into how to get rid of PCOS. So at the time, this was about 2012, 2013, what I saw was, don't have gluten, don't have dairy, don't have refined sugar. And I was like, your girl's doing paleo. Check, check, check. You know, we got it. Like, so I was like, well, it looks like I'm doing everything right. So I guess I'll just paleo harder. And so because nothing changed. Yeah. And I was still struggling with all these symptoms. And I ended up, you know, I got convinced to go to centralized doctors and go get some medication so I could get some relief from my symptoms. And so they gave me spironolactone and they gave me metformin, which are very common for women who have PCOS. Mm-hmm. And the metformin is a little bit of a foreshadowing moment. And if you don't know what metformin does, don't worry, you'll know in a second, but I didn't know what it did at the time. And had I known, it would have cued me into what was really going on at the root of this, but I didn't know. So I was on these medications, got some help from my, you know, with the symptoms, ended up getting off the medications, kind of maintaining, but I was always still in the background, listening to podcasts, reading blogs, trying to figure out what is happening here. And finally, one day, years later, I hear a podcast where someone said PCOS is the diabetes of the ovaries. And I was like, what? Like, what are you talking about? And I was like, I need to start looking into this because I don't know anything about diabetes, except, like I said, they get the pink sugar packet, something about sugar, something about sugar. And a lot of my patients in the nursing homes had amputations. And literally that's all I knew about diabetes. So it was something that I always skipped over. So I have all these books back here and I was always, you know, reading these books and I'd get to the blood sugar chapter and I was like, I don't have diabetes, skip. So I just literally skipped it because I didn't relate to it. I didn't think it was relevant to me. I don't have family members with diabetes. I think a lot of them have insulin resistance. A lot of them have heart disease. I think it's manifestations of insulin resistance, but not quite diabetes. So it just was not on my radar. I did not associate myself with having blood sugar issues. And like I said, I didn't really know what symptoms of blood sugar issues were. I thought, that sounds boring and complicated. I don't really want to learn about that. So I would just skip these chapters. So I finally dove into learning about symptoms of blood sugar issues. And I was like, okay, I thought these were my personality traits. Like I used to say, I don't have a sweet tooth. All my teeth are sweet. Like I always needed a little something sweet at meals. I was a dessert person. I would wake up shaky and say like, oh, it's just because I'm a breakfast person. I need to eat early. I was like this person. I was a foodie. Yeah. And that's why I carried granola bars in my purse. So it was a lot of these things where it was like, my own personality traits. I was the hangry friend. That's not the, all of those things that I listed are not fixed personality, you know, traits. They are symptoms of blood sugar dysregulation and metabolic issues. So I also started seeing that I potentially had low blood sugar issues because, you know, when I looked back at all the lab work that I got, my blood sugar was, and I'm sorry, I'm going to have to get a calculator out here. But my blood sugar was 63. So dividing that by 18 to get the millimoles, it was about a 3.5 around that three mark.
Wow.
Every single time I went to go get my blood work that year that I had PCOS, it was always low 60s or like around that 3.5, 3.3 Whoa. Mark. And so I would say I hate fasting blood work. I'd be shaky. My head would feel like a balloon. I almost passed out one time. Like I was going to get in my car. I specifically remember I like fell backwards and I like caught myself, but I'm like, whoa. And I remember smelling Dunkin' Donuts, like wafting. I was like, I'd give anything, but like, it was this crazy reaction. And I didn't tell the doctor about that. I was just like, this is so annoying. And none of the doctors that I saw, and I mean, I got labs done like four times at least that year. None of the doctors said anything. One of them circled it, but didn't talk to me about it.
Whoa.
So it was just so missed. It was so not on the radar. And so I started to use strategies to support better blood sugar. And I changed my paleo diet to a ketogenic macros, keeping the real food. And so I got into nutritional ketosis. Luckily I did circadian aligned fasting where I would skip dinner because I was still that breakfast person. I still like to wake up and eat and I wasn't that hungry at night. So I didn't eat breakfast or I would do a small breakfast, dinner or early dinner, but I definitely ate breakfast every day. And within 5 months, I had no more signs of PCOS, not one. And wow. So, yeah, it was amazing. And, but then, I became a nutritional therapist. I started helping people with their blood sugar and metabolic health. I didn't really go the PCOS route because I was like, whatever this is how we get rid of it. Why focus on this? So I'm not a PCOS expert, but I will say that no matter what form of PCOS people have, I truly believe it is a manifestation of metabolic issues, whether insulin resistance, leptin resistance, some combination of those things at play. And when we can work on those, and of course, there's an inflammatory component as well, but insulin resistance is inherently an inflammatory state. So that often drives the hormones to be what they are. So if a woman is still getting a cycle, I feel the way to balance out those the sex hormones are to really work on the metabolic hormones and the stress. And that's really the way out of it. So I started working as a holistic nutritional therapy practitioner. And as you read in my bio, I was working with people and, you know, got amazing results. And I felt really proud of what I was doing and helping people reverse type 2 diabetes and pre-diabetes and hypoglycemia and all sorts of things. And then there were just these people that were not getting better and they were doing everything right, quote unquote. And I was just like, you know, they're not wrong. I need more tools. And so at that time, a good friend of mine, Sarah Kleiner, was starting to post stuff about her own journey with infertility and how she was able to have a baby at 42, 43. And she was doing all these quantum and circadian approaches. Like I would start to see things like grounding and sunlight and things like that. And I was living back in Florida at this time. So I was outside all the time. You know, I was getting lots of light and sunlight and some grounding in there. And so I didn't have my own health transformation that much with some of these quantum and circadian practices, but I started to really learn about things from this perspective. And one of the things that just, it wasn't just, I learned one thing and my mind was changed. It was just a combination of a couple of things that really just blew my mind that I'm like, oh my gosh. So I took one of Carrie Bennett's courses on the mitochondria, and she was talking about electrons and protons. And she was saying that inflammation is an excess of protons. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, I don't know. For me, that just blew my mind. And I was, one of the sayings that I used to say in my practice was, don't be a calorie avoider, be a nutrient seeker. And yep. Now we need to be electron seekers. And it was like, wow, okay. So our body's only supposed to get a third of its energy from food, and mm-hmm. the rest should come from, you know, sunshine, grounding, movement. And it's, and like our friend Kelsey Dexter says, we as humans were designed to get energy from above and from below. Yep. And that makes so much sense to me. And it's just everything that I learned about quantum and circadian biology. There was complexity in the science, but then this beautiful simplicity in how it played out. And it yep. was like, oh, you mean touch a blade of grass? Like, okay, I think I can handle that. Oh, you mean get natural light in my eyes, just crack a window? Like, it was just, it just made so much sense. So I started learning especially about light and how infrared light is really supportive for the mitochondria to utilize glucose more efficiently. So it lowers our blood sugar and, you know, the grounding, it has that anti-inflammatory effect and we get all these electrons. And so I started to tell some of my clients who had this very persistent dawn phenomenon where the blood sugar is spiking in the morning, it's staying elevated. And I started having them, I'm like, I want you to go outside. I want you to watch sunrise every day and keep track of what your blood sugar is doing. And I had people who were at like a stagnant 104, 105 blood sugar. I'm doing the math right now. Give me a second. That would be about a 5.7. Mm-hmm. And so just stuck there with their fasting blood sugar. And within a couple of weeks, even less than that, a couple of days, some of them, it was down to like an 82, 83, which is about a 4.6. Wow. So in just a couple of days, I would see people. I mean, we worked on this with one of my clients who, you know, because she was on our retreat, so we can't say her name. She was able to get off her metformin, reverse her insulin resistance. And, you know, she was like, her blood sugar graph was like a flat line all day. And it was beautiful, you know, in the, you know, 80s and 90s. And it, just the morning blood sugar, I'm like, what is happening? You know, so we did all this stuff with the liver and all these things and nothing was moving it. And then she goes outside for a couple of weeks and it's just like, boom, perfect. Yeah. So that was, it was really amazing to see these breakthroughs and what I was struggling with. And then, you know, learning about our circadian rhythm and meal timing and having people who are chronic breakfast skippers, I'd always said, you know, it's better to, you know, eat in the morning, but I allowed quote unquote people to be chronic breakfast skippers. And all of a sudden we started to give them breakfast and skip dinner instead. And their blood sugar came down, their cortisol levels came down, they started to sleep better, they started to not feel so hungry, they broke through plateaus. And it just, I had such a buy-in to these methods. And so it was amazing to see. And I would say that the one thing that really improved with me, you know, there's a couple of things, like my mood really, really improves when I'm doing all the quantum and circadian practices. But I had LASIK and I feel regretful about that. But luckily I didn't have any horrible side effects. But after I got LASIK, my eyes definitely were not 20/20. They were probably more like 20/35. I needed glasses to drive at night. Things looked kind of blurry. I'd kind of have to clear my eyes and squint a lot so I could see, especially close. I feel like my eyes would be dry. And then as soon as they were a little dry, they would get a little fuzzy. And I mean, now I feel like I have hawk vision and I never have to do that clearing of my eyes. My eyes aren't dry anymore. And all of a sudden I realize, okay, all the natural light that I'm getting, all the infrared, all the, you know, building that exclusion zone in my eyes, getting that cellular hydration in my eyes. I don't even know where those glasses are. I drive with blue blockers on at night, not my glasses to see, you know, street signs. So that was an amazing thing, but yeah. And then to wrap it up, I realized that as I was learning about the quantum and circadian stuff, I realized that my other story that I told you earlier with the blood sugar and everything, there's a light story. There's a circadian component there because I was eating this healthy, quote unquote, healthy paleo diet in Miami, Florida, and not having any issues. And when I moved to New York to a higher latitude and it was winter and I continued eating acai bowls and fruit smoothies and bananas blended in my iced coffee with coconut sugar. And I was like, oh, I wonder what's happening. There's a, you know, absolute deuterium story there and out of season foods. And my, you know, I was inside. Well, I was outside. I was outside a lot because I had to walk and, you know, travel to where I had to go, but I wasn't up with sunrise and, you know, I had the lights on at night, the city that never sleeps. And so my whole circadian rhythm was shifted and that's why I was so tired and I couldn't wake up in the morning and I was sleeping so late into the day and it just made so much sense. And then I realized that the time when I actually lost the most weight with the most ease was originally when I first moved to Miami. I was obsessed with being tan. So coming from New York, if anyone's ever seen Jersey Shore, Long Island's pretty similar to that. And so I grew up with like needing to be tan as it, like being tan was such a flex. So whenever I'm tan, like it was so ingrained into me, like, oh, you're so tan. Like it was such a compliment. I'm half Italian like you, Mark. And so we can tan, you know?
We can.
And so when I got to Miami, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to get so tan. So I was outside all the time, getting super tan and weight just poured off. So it was crazy that I realized, oh my gosh, okay. You know, my leptin melanocortin pathways are really firing here and able to just drop that weight. And so, but unfortunately when I had the PCOS and I moved back to Miami after New York, I was bought into sunscreen. And so I had sunscreen on, I wasn't getting tan, I had my sunglasses, a hat on. And so I didn't get that rebound like I could have if I had embraced all that stuff. So it's just cool to look back and see, oh yeah, this was at play. And I really think that, again, this tan flex thing. So when I was little, I grew up on Long Island and we lived 10 minutes away from the beach. And so all summer long, you can't go all year round. You could go basically June, July, August, September, and like maybe September. So we're going like three and a half, four months of the year. But my mom was always like, Danielle, stick your face in the sun, like always wanting me to get tan, which was the opposite of a lot of moms slathering in sunscreen. And so I truly think that getting tan in the summer and actually getting vitamin D, like had she put sunscreen on me, I think I would have been an autoimmune.
Yep.
I truly think that the sun, even in my youth, it really saved me from going on like over that that line to autoimmunity. So that's my whole story. It feels like way too long. So
not at all, not at all, not at all. That was fascinating. And in my head, I'm thinking, remember that point, remember that point, remember that point, come back to that, come back to that, come back. So there's quite a few epiphic moments in there for you on this journey. But obviously, just one of the ones that's just been said, which is for people that are watching, which may, well, they potentially might get triggered by certain things. I don't mind if you do. This isn't about being woke. I don't care about all of that stuff. This is the anti-woke podcast. Not interested in any of that.
Yeah.
You mentioned not putting on sunscreen, which all of a sudden, anybody that's not heard that yet is going to go, what? Sun causes cancer. You must put on lead-based sunscreen. Annie, please, for all of the people listening who are having their mind completely blown for a moment.
Yeah.
Why is not putting on your sunglasses, your hat, and your sunscreen a good idea?
Yeah. So first off, I just want to take everyone back. I want everyone to think about their ancestors, you know, thousands of years ago, hundreds of years ago. And I want you to like ask yourself, okay, did these people have sunscreen? No, they didn't. Were they dropping dead of cancer and skin cancer in the streets? Well, there weren't streets on the paths. No. Where did they live? Did they live inside? No, they lived outside. So for all of our human history, we have lived outside under the sun, exposed to the sun all the time. And our ancestors, because we have white skin, migrated from the, you know, from the equatorial regions north, more north, and we lost melanin in our skin. So the our bodies are so smart, and we evolved on this planet with the sun. So if the sun was trying to kill us, we would not have survived as a species up till now. And so, you know, I am not suggesting, hey, just go fry in the sun. Like, Mark, why don't you right now in the middle of February, living in the UK, just go to Jamaica and just lay on the beach, you know, don't use sunscreen. That would be stupid. I'm not saying that at all. So our skin is so powerful that it has so many different mechanisms to keep us protected. But also, you know, UVB light is the only type of light that makes vitamin D. And our ancestors also did not have vitamin D capsules. And also, if we think that the sun, which gives life to all life on Earth, is equivalent to a factory-made substance, we're mistaken. So I don't suggest that we go out in the sun and fry ourselves, but there's a couple of things that I want people to learn about. So first off, we need to look at our Fitzpatrick skin type. So you can just go on Google and Google Fitzpatrick skin type, and you can see where you lie on that. On that spectrum. So a one on the spectrum would be maybe someone from like Ireland who's super pale, light eyes, freckles, always burns, never tans, lighter hair, redder hair, something like that, all the way up to a six, which is someone with probably African equatorial ancestry, very dark black skin, never burns, dark eyes. And so then we find ourselves somewhere in between that, that one to six spectrum, right? And so if you are, first of all, we have to look, are we a match to where we are at our latitude with our Fitzpatrick skin type? So we've all migrated all over the place. So if you are in a higher Fitzpatrick skin type, darker skin, and you moved more north or south towards the poles, you're actually at quite a disadvantage. And this is difficult. And I really want people to hear this. So if you have dark skin, you need to hear that you already have that darkness in your skin is melanin, and melanin is amazing. But one of the things it does is it acts like a natural sunscreen. So that's why people from equatorial regions who are exposed to lots of sun have darker skin. It is simply because they have that built-in sunscreen before we had, you know, copper tone. It's the built-in sunscreen that our body makes and has in there to protect us from the sun. But the thing is that when you have all this melanin, the more melanin you have, the more time outside you need in high intensity sunlight to get vitamin D in a to sufficiency. So if you are from Jamaica and you live in Jamaica, like your whole family's from Jamaica, chances are you're at a great match. So you're not going to need to use sunscreen, anything like that. If you are of Irish ancestry and you move to Miami, Florida, so the sort of the opposite, the low Fitzpatrick moving closer to the equator, this is where it gets trickier because the sun is so much stronger than your skin is prepared to experience. So you may need some sunscreen at some point, but I'm going to talk about how we kind of build up our own natural sun protection. So what I recommend is that we don't go out in midday sunlight, in strong sunlight, without what we call a solar callus. I think that term was coined by Jack Cruz. And this is really like, think about, you know, you get calluses when you weightlift to protect your hands, because at first it's all ripped and bloody, but then you get the calluses and they're nice and strong and they protect you. Same thing with a solar callus, or as we call on Long Island, a base tan. And so you want to get this nice base tan. But there's steps to doing this. And so again, if we look at our ancestors, they were outside almost all the time, right? And so they experienced the sun in its full spectrum. So that's what we want to mimic, because it's built, there's built-in mechanisms in the sun to protect us. So the first thing is that sunrise light is very rich in red and infrared light. And this light prepares the skin to receive these harsher intensities of the UVA and UVB. So we want to get that sunrise light in our eyes for a myriad of reasons, but also on our skin to condition, prepare the skin, lower inflammation, support our glucose. But that's really going to help us to be able to get into these other wavelengths without any issue. So then the sun moves to this, to the point in the sky, 10 to 30 degrees off the horizon, where UVA light is predominant. Everyone says that this light is bad and it's going to age your skin and all this stuff. And like, okay, we get a little photo aging, but it's also doing a lot of amazing things. It gives us endorphins. It converts, we convert amino acids. This light hits us and we get serotonin, we get dopamine, we get norepinephrine, we get thyroid hormones. So yes, sign me up for that. And then UVA also starts to build melanin. And that melanin is this protector for us in the UVB. So we want to expose ourselves to sunrise light with all the infrared. We want to expose ourselves to UVA, start building melanin. And then we want to gradually increase our time spent in UVB light. Now, a lot of people didn't know this, Mark, when I put this poll on my stories. I said, can you make vitamin D from sunrise light? Because all you hear nowadays are people saying, get outside for sunrise, get outside for sunrise. And so they're like, you know, I hear huge accounts, like really popular accounts on Instagram, then saying, get outside for sunrise, get your vitamin D, you know, walk after your breakfast, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, that's incorrect. You cannot make vitamin D from any other light except for UVB.
Correct.
Right? So UVB light is available all year round near the equator, but in the northern and southern hemispheres, pretty much only in spring and summer months. So if you're above, I think the 35th latitude, is it? Yep. 33rd? One of those, you will lose UVB light during your winter. So here in Austin, Texas, I have UVB all the time, but you also need it to be at a certain intensity. So the UV index needs to be about like a 4 or 5. I've heard different things between a 3 and a 5. Do you have a specific number you've heard?
I thought it was 4, but if it's between 3 and 5, we'll just take that as an average.
Exactly. So it should be above a 4-ish to actually make vitamin D. So right now, I think if you're new to this, your mind will be blown that like, are you kidding me? I can't go outside and make vitamin D all the time. We just associate the sun to vitamin D, but it's really at those peak hours of the day. And when do they tell you to stay out of the sun? During the peak hours times of the day. So they say, don't go in the sun from 11 to 2. And it's like, well, that's the only time where there's UVB. So if we don't expose ourselves to this, then we will never get vitamin D sufficiency. And good luck having really good blood sugar, metabolic health, immune function, staying away, like avoiding getting cancer if you stay out of the sun at this time. And again, a vitamin D capsule is not even close to the same as full spectrum sunlight and high intensity UVB light. So we want to gradually increase our amount of time in this UV. So we want to avoid burning. And then there's a lot of things that we can do. Oh, sorry, I didn't finish. We want to avoid burning, build up the solar callus, and the solar callus allows us to stay outside longer and longer in that UVB light without any damage. So like when I'm very tan in the middle of summer, I can go out and I don't need sunscreen, and that's allowing me to absorb more vitamin D. And if you have lighter skin and you have ever had like a bathing suit tan, so especially the ladies where we wear a bathing suit, it's shaped one way and then the strap goes the other way. And so we have like a whiter patch on our skin. What you may have noticed is if you go in the sun, you get burned in the white patch, but you are tan everywhere else. That is the perfect example of the solar callus, is that the white skin is going to burn really, really quickly. So, and then I have had clients, and I'm sure you have had clients too, Mark, who have said, I have never tanned in my whole life and I cannot believe it. I have a tan.
Yes. 100%.
So, yeah. Yeah. Yep. So I truly believe that everyone can get a little bit of a tan. And remember, this is where safe and smart practices come in. So we also want to get the sunset light, which is rich in the infrareds again. The other day, it was way too cold to stay outside for the sunset light. So I used my red light therapy panel. And, you know, if you feel like, ooh, I got a little bit too much, I'm a little too red. I mean, this thing, it just, or the sunset, it just pulls that red right out. Like it really helps mitigate the burn. So this whole practice is smart sun exposure. It's deliberate sun exposure. It's not reckless, careless, nonchalant, you know, sun exposure, which can be harmful, right? The sun is strong. So we want to respect it. We want to learn how to get its benefits and mitigate these risks. Yep. So turning to sunscreen, hat, you know, sunglasses, how do those things fit in? So I would say that we want to keep in mind that, let's say, let's take this, our Irish friend who's visiting Miami, right? Or lives in Miami now. You know, she's going to be able to get a solar callus up to a certain point, but she is probably not going to be able to tolerate, as a Fitzpatrick one, any sort of like a high amount of midday sunlight in Miami, Florida. And that's okay, because just by being out, let's say 10 to 10:30, you know, that little amount, if there's UVB at that point, she could probably get all the vitamin D she needs, because again, it's not working through a lot of melanin. She's just getting all that vitamin D, and then would want to think about doing things to cover up. So you would want to go in the shade, use clothing, or use a mineral-based sunscreen to protect yourself. You know, it's not ideal, but again, if you're at this big mismatch, or if you're like traveling from Canada, going on a vacation in the middle of winter to Mexico, this is where we have things like sunscreen to help protect us from overexposure. But you want to follow all those things first, and really get that solar callus going, so you don't need to use that as much. So my goal this year is to not use sunscreen at all. But I'm also not above putting it on my face, because, you know, there is some photo aging. I don't know how you feel about that, Mark. And maybe, you know, I don't do it a lot. I tend to use shade and hats as much as possible. But if it's not possible for me to use shade and a hat, you know, if I'm out on a boat or if I'm just exposed, I want to avoid burning. So I would use that. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, I won't be using sunglasses, because sunglasses will prevent the proper light signal from going in your eye. Your skin doesn't, you know, your body doesn't think it's getting strong UV light. And so it won't produce all those protective mechanisms, like all the melanin and even some of those histamine responses that tell our body, like, oh, it's time to get out of the sun. So it having sunglasses on actually prevents you increases your risk of getting a sunburn, which is what we want to avoid. And then food wise, we want to think about having, you know, avoiding seed oils, because those will oxidize in our skin. We want to have lots of really healthy animal fats that are low in deuterium and really stable. Lots of omega-3s, of course, because these are going to be anti-inflammatory and also support the skin health. And lots of polyphenols in these, you know, seasonal fruits and vegetables to help support our skin during that time. So what we don't want to be doing is, you know, eating a well, I was going to say a bag of chips or chips, any kind of chips, you know, fried in seed oils, and, you know, drinking alcohol out in the sun, and then slathering ourselves with chemical sunscreen, which has known carcinogenic ingredients that are then baking into our skin in high intensity UV light. So I think that there, you know, there's okay, I was fighting with ChatGPT about this. And I was like, are there any studies that show that the sun causes skin cancer? And it's like, it's important to cover up in the sun, blah, blah. I'm like, no. I'm like all of the studies that have been done with narrow band UV light. And I just told you that that's not what the sun is. It's not just narrow band UV light. There's always infrared, which helps heal and soothe and balance. And there's UVA, and there's like all these different things going on with the sun. And so the studies on skin cancer, I just feel are so inaccurate. And so I finally got it to say, I'm like, answer me in one word. Have there ever been any conclusive studies that conclude that the sun causes skin cancer? And it says no. And I was like, there you go. So the sun by itself does not, it's not inherently trying to give you skin cancer or any kind of cancer. It's actually anti-cancer because of all these effects that we just mentioned. And it's how we get vitamin D and how we modulate our immune system and getting all this amazing infrared and supporting our mitochondria and building exclusion zone water, supporting our negative charge. Because when we're out there, we're probably grounding too, right? We're getting sun and we're grounding. And so we're building this beautiful exclusion zone around our cells. And that is helping us not get cancer. So, you know, there's so much to it, but that's the vitamin D UVB story.
That was incredible, my darling. And I'm sure there are people there who have just had their minds completely blown, completely blown. So to add to that, some things, no, I'm not adverse to sunscreen. However, I'm adverse to chemical sunscreen. So for everybody that's listening and watching, we met properly when we were both in El Salvador at the Solar Culture Retreat, which I might like add, there was like 30 plus people there, all from different parts of the world, and not a single one of us burnt in the middle of El Salvador at 36 to 39 degrees. So we all built our solar callus because, as you quite rightly stated, you can build a solar callus in the sense of producing melanin as long as there's UVA. So we can go out in sunrise and we can go out at UVA, and that's going to help start to produce the melanin. And you can do that in winter. UVA never goes anywhere. So I'm currently building my solar callus in the middle of winter because I'm that weird guy in the middle of the park with his top off in -2 conditions because I want to build my melanin. And the sunscreen that I would use would be a mineral one, as you stated. So you can get ones that come with a tallow base because tallow is obviously going to have the fat absorbable vitamins in it, which is going to help drive it into the skin. It's not going to cause any kind of endocrine issues or anything like that. Or it's not like going to start messing around with hormones, basically, is what I'm saying. It's not going to be a toxin. I actually had some with me when we were in El Salvador. I only used it in the highest points of the day if we were outside, but we were rarely outside, not in shade at that time of the day. So yes, ladies and gentlemen, you can build your solar callus in winter. Absolutely. And Danny is quite right. Taking a tablet instead of being out in the sun is not how it's meant to go, because there are, I think, over 13 different forms of vitamin D, where the one you're getting in your supplement is just the one. And we have to remember that it's not a vitamin, it's a hormone, and a very, very important one. And there are roles that are played here. So in the summertime, or whenever you can get UVB and produce vitamin D or synthesize vitamin D in the body, that's when you're going to be making it. And you want to be stockpiling that through most of the summer. Because then when you go to wintertime and you don't have your UVB, this is where melatonin takes over, because vitamin D and melatonin both work through the same receptor and same pathway. So melatonin then takes over in the winter. And here's a really critical point, is vitamin D is obviously then stored in the fat cells. So if you get cold, and you can do, I mean, you don't have to ice bath for this. You can just go for a walk in winter with some lighter clothing on and just get a bit cold. That vitamin D then gets liberated from the fat cells because of the cold, and it now starts circulating around the body. So there are many ways of doing this. It's just that we've not been told them. So I think that's very, very important for people to hear. So thank you for explaining all of that. Then there was one other thing which you mentioned right at the beginning, talking about insulin resistance. You mentioned leptin resistance, which some people may have heard. glanced over and not thought about, but it's a very, very important topic. Now, I'm not expecting a deep dive because you've been deep diving for 47 minutes so far, and I don't want to take up all your brain power for today. So explain to people from a metabolic standpoint why leptin resistance is so important to understand and rectify and fix or heal, whichever word you'd like to choose.
Yeah. So I'm not an expert on leptin, but I'm just starting to learn about it. And I, you know, I'm not a scientist either. And so I like to put things in terms that my brain understands. And so what I, the takeaways that I get from learning about leptin, I knew it initially as our satiety hormone. And that's not wrong, but it's incomplete. And leptin is definitely a master hormone. It controls a lot of things. But one of the main things that leptin does and its purpose is to tell the body how much energy it has stored on it. So how many nutrients we have, how much glycogen or stored sugars in our liver, how much body fat we have, how much charge, negative charge we have. So leptin, it goes up to the brain, up to the hypothalamus every night to give this rundown of how much energy we have stored on it. And that signaling is so important, especially when it comes to, you know, blood sugar and metabolism and, you know, overeating and sugar cravings and all this stuff, because if there's resistance to the leptin, meaning it's not getting that the communication, or if we're doing things like spiking our blood sugar at night and we have a lot of insulin in our system, and the hypothalamus is going to actually prefer the insulin, it's going to dock at the receptors where the leptin should go. So that's preventing the leptin from giving the information, this energy rundown to the brain. And this also happens with low leptin as well, where it's like things are low. And so it's kind of with leptin resistance, the body thinks there's low leptin. So the body is going to think that there's been a famine, that there's famine, there's stress, there's not a lot of food available, there's scarcity. So it really can signal to the body scarcity or abundance. And in that way, it helps to regulate our appetite and our body weight. So to give a real life example to make this make a little bit more sense, or how my brain likes to understand it, is let's say how it should work is leptin will go up to the brain in the night and say, you know, hey, here's how much stored energy Dani has on her body. She's got this much body fat, she's got this much XYZ. And you know what? It's a little excess. So tomorrow, let's lower her appetite a little bit and feel free to upregulate some of that fat burning, and feel free to, you know, dip into the liver glycogen. We have excess. And so let's, you know, come back down to baseline. So that's one way that leptin can help regulate your body weight, right? Is by saying, oh, this is excess. Let's burn a little bit of this. Let's lower the appetite and burn what we have because there's been abundance. But if the body is perceiving there's scarcity because of leptin resistance, the insulin getting in the way, or low leptin, then the brain doesn't get this rundown from leptin. And so it assumes that you're starving. It's going to assume that there's scarcity and famine and you're running from tigers. And so what it's going to do is say, oh my gosh, we don't have any stored energy on board. Tomorrow, I need you to raise Dani's appetite. You know what? Maybe right now in the middle of the night, why don't you wake her up with stress and make her go hunt? You know, you might say tomorrow, raise her appetite, make her a little anxious. So she really goes out there and gets food, and do not even think of touching any of that stored energy because we don't have it anyway. Right. Yep. So it's like it puts blinders on the metabolism. So it doesn't know it can use glycogen in between meals to stabilize your blood sugar. It doesn't think you have body fat to burn when you're going overnight. And so the signaling of the leptin, when that gets, you know, impaired, then that causes all these metabolic issues. And so what we see with leptin resistance oftentimes is that people will gain weight and not be able to lose it. And leptin resistance and insulin resistance also goes hand in hand. So we have insulin telling the body to store fat and reducing lipolysis, which is fat burning. And then we have leptin saying there is no fat to burn anyway. So you're holding on to this excess fat and your hormones are blocking you from burning it. And what do you feel? You feel tired. You have sugar cravings. You want fast energy. You can't stop thinking about food. Like, you feel like you don't have willpower, and you exercise and all this stuff, but nothing happens.
Yep.
That could be a leptin resistant person. The other thing that I see people on the other end. I see low leptin and oftentimes low insulin with that. And these people can still have elevated blood sugar. So the high leptin, high insulin people often will have elevated blood sugar. But also I see low leptin, low insulin, and high blood sugar. I believe that these low leptin people, they're typically people who are potentially type A, over exercise, over fast, over keto, over cut carbs, skip breakfast, do all the things, but
extremes.
Too many things. And oftentimes they are women who are doing things like men. Women have a 30-day cycle, and these lovely women, type A, go-getter, doing all the things, trying so hard. Unfortunately, they're disrupting things because they're not giving themselves these periods of rest. It's like, no, I have to do HIIT workouts. And then you could be low leptin and overweight. And so they're like, you know, going so hard, and they're like, well, I can't stop now. I can't lose weight. And the, unfortunately, when you're doing all those like over-exercising, you know, yo-yo dieting, extreme restricting in some way, that is sending a message to your body that, again, there's scarcity. So those strategies work beautifully well for the high leptin, high insulin people, right? Mm-hmm. Intermittent fasting, cold exposure, cutting calories or cutting carbs, ketosis, like all those things lower leptin because they're sending a scarcity signal to the body, basically.
Yep.
And like really hard work, working out. It's like working out all the time, and it's like, oh, my body's running from a tiger. And we're doing that when you're high leptin, high insulin to bring you back down to normal. But if you are low leptin, please, friends, get your leptin checked. And, you know, I was told leptin 7 to 10, but it really does depend on your body weight. But if your leptin is like super low, chances are your body is overly stressed. So you want to take stressors off the table then, because if the body is too stressed out and you're like, I need to do this HIIT workout, it's like, no, baby girl, you are going to do some yoga. You know, I want you to go for a gentle 10-minute walk after each meal, you know, like not a 3-hour walk, because it's like, you're still trying to get a lot of exercise. It's like gentle, gentle, gentle. We want to take stressors away from the body. Instead of a cold plunge, maybe we dip our face in cold or do the wrists. Maybe we don't do extended sauna periods and we do red light therapy panel instead. Maybe we stop skipping meals and we have all three meals and maybe a mini meal in between if your blood sugar is crashing. I don't want people to push through that feeling of like the jittery, hangry, shaky. Don't push through that. Because then what happens is your adrenals come in and pump you with stress hormones and we deplete them further. Oftentimes in this low leptin space, there's so much cortisol dysregulation and potentially circadian dysregulation, which is when these cortisol patterns are off and the melatonin's too high in the morning and we're tired and that's why we can't wake up. We have to dial in our circadian rhythm, because not knowing what time it is a huge stressor for the body. It is an underestimated stressor for the body. So that's contributing to the stress load. Remember, these low leptin people, the body's like, oh my God, everything's stressful. There's a famine, there's tigers, right? So we have to take the tigers away. We have to take the stress away, and we have to give the body signs that it is safe. And we do that by helping it know what time it is. So aligning our circadian rhythm with what's happening outside our window, by taking away the high intensity workouts and adding more mindfulness and stress-based things and journaling, getting our feelings out and, you know, setting boundaries in our life. And then when it comes to food, we want to eat breakfast. We want to signal to leptin there's food around. Carbs at breakfast can be okay for low leptin people, can be really supportive, but we want to get lots and lots of protein and healthy fat. We want to eat at those regular meal times, eat, you know, after the sun comes up, and then go for a walk. Don't do the walk and then breakfast. We want to give our body nourishment, we want it to be like, oh, there is food. That's what we want it to think. We want it to be like, It's not a famine. Okay. Yeah. So that's how we want to eat. And then stabilizing our blood sugar is another really important characteristic of healing low leptin, because if our blood sugar is swinging all the time, what is that? Very stressful. We have our adrenals coming in. We have, oh my gosh, the energy is going low. By stabilizing our blood sugar, we have a continuous source of energy for the body. So it's like, okay, we have lots of energy coming in. So this is where I sometimes see ketosis even being supportive for some of my low leptin people who have a lot of blood sugar dysregulation. Because yes, there is a stress component to ketosis, but cost-benefit analysis, there's less of a cost of doing the stress of ketosis and more of a benefit from having stable energy to the brain. So it could be like, oh, there's so much fat here. I can use all of this. I can have energy. So ketosis can be a strategy on either end of this leptin spectrum, but we want to stabilize blood sugar, give the body the fuel it needs, take away stressors, take away the HIIT workouts, maybe not do intense sauna, depending on like how severe this is. You know, I have a lot of people and they're debilitated by these blood sugar crashes and they feel weak and dizzy and shaky and anxious and, you know, they're missing their period and, or all these things that it's like too much stress. So we want the leptin signaling to come in and be like abundance, 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 and that will get us back up. And one more thing that I think is really interesting is that when people have low leptin, what I've learned is that they often get a higher insulin response at meals. And if I think sort of historically as to why would the body do this, because it's very smart, so I need to figure out why this would happen, it makes sense to me that if your leptin is low and the body thinks there's scarcity, it would want to give you a lot of insulin because the insulin is going to help store fat. And so it's going to be like, here we go. We're going to put on whatever she's eating. We're going to store every bit of it. Yep. So that is often why I get a lot of people with sort of that, reactive hypoglycemic type things after meals when they have low leptin as well. So those are some of the things I'm learning about it. And then also the importance of light, because leptin is, it's got benzene rings on it. It's like, it's very, you know, stimulated by light. So we have to talk about, we can't just talk about, you know, diet and stressors. We also have to bring in all of the circadian and light components. So it's really important to block blue light at night, really important to get, you know, proper lighting signaling in through your eyes all throughout the day, especially in the morning, but also throughout the day, as you know, we just talked about. So
agreed.
Long story.
No, Dani, that was, you know, I'd actually want to give you a round of applause. I think that was absolutely brilliant, because we know leptin resistance is going to be preceding insulin resistance. So
I don't always see that happen.
Oh, really?
Yes. I've heard that. Heard that, but I've not always seen it. I've seen people with high insulin and normal leptin.
Interesting. Okay. So I need to dig into that research a little bit.
I know. And I also, just a couple of people. So
yeah. No, listen, there's always going to be what's the word I'm looking for here? There's always going to be outliers with these types of things, always. Mm-hmm. But what's I going to say there about leptin?
You were going to say leptin resistance precedes insulin resistance.
Yeah. Oh, light. Yes. Yeah.
There's
a reason, another reason why leptin is so linked to light. And that's because obviously when it does get released, gets released from the body, from the fat cells, go into the hypothalamus to dock so that it can start giving us all this, our brain, all this information as to what to do with our energy levels and what have you. This happens at night. So obviously this is all going to then come down to blue light frequency and lux or brightness of light at night. So if you are, and again, no judgment, but if you are sat there, you know, because nobody watches TV anymore, they have the TV on while watching their phone. So you've now got your TV giving, you've now got your TV giving your brain the signal that it's midday and it's blue light. And I'll explain that, why that's important in a minute. And in your phone doing the same thing. So you've now got two devices at an exceptional amount of lux brightness saying, it's midday. So your brain's going, okay, well then no point leptin being, right? No point leptin being released, because we're still going to need to do things. You know, most people are going to be eating at that time as well, which is basically telling the body, oh, we're still awake and it's still daytime. So we're going to get all those things going on. But also isolated blue light on its own is going to raise cortisol levels through ATCH, It's going to raise hunger signals through the alpha melanocortin system, as well as increase blood sugar. Mm-hmm. And it's also going to release a peptide called CLIP, which is going to be an insulin secretagogue. So what's happening there is basically your body is releasing blood sugar, raising cortisol, increasing hunger, and raising insulin. These are all really bad metabolic things to be happening at night.
At night, yes.
Because we don't want elevated cortisol because that's going to keep us awake. We don't want hunger because that's going to make us think it's daytime. We don't want increases in blood sugar and insulin because that's going to cause metabolic dysregulation. And now all of a sudden, leptin's there going, yeah, but it's surely my turn. I haven't been released for like 3 months. Surely it's my turn. I need to be released. And so you're basically sending the signal of daytime all the time. Literally, yeah. Other than maybe 6 hours of the day, mm-hmm. you are like from whenever it is that you do go to sleep and wake up, you are basically telling your body it's always midday.
Yeah.
This is a really, 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 really bad thing because as Danny stated right at the beginning of the leptin story, mm-hmm. leptin is a master hormone.
Yeah.
It is so, so critical because otherwise if we're getting this inverse cortisol stuff going on and we get this massively elevated cortisol all the time, particularly for women, men as well, but mostly for women, is you're going to get this pregnenolone steal syndrome. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, pregnenolone, when it gets released from the mitochondria in the morning, which should be being used for all the steroidal hormones, the body goes, nah, we need more cortisol because all we keep doing is pumping cortisol. So we just need more cortisol. And your adrenals are going, but mate, please, please, I've been working every day, 24 hours. I need a break. So we then start getting these hypofunctional adrenal symptoms and other stuff like that. So
low thyroid. It really tanks thyroid.
Mm-hmm. Massively. And it's
sex hormones. Yeah.
Yep. Everything. So mm-hmm. all the hormonal dysregulation that we see in clients, all the thyroid issues, neurological things, depression, mm-hmm. anxiety, all this stuff is all then linked to leptin at the same time. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we've covered a lot of ground in this mm-hmm. podcast, I believe, and I don't want to make people's heads explode. do you think there is anything else that we need to add, or do you think we've covered the most important points? Do you think, actually, let me rephrase that.
Sure.
Is there, if I articulate that correctly, 1 to 3 things uh-huh. that you could recommend the listeners or the viewers to maybe try? Like if mm-hmm. they're thinking, oh my God, this is so overwhelming. I don't know what to do. I don't know where I should start, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, start here.
Okay. I would start with the night because it makes getting outside in the morning easier. Yep. So I would start with switching out, like just turning off overhead lights, if that's the best you could do for now, and then leaning into more amber and fire toned lighting. So it could be fire. So light your fireplace in the winter. Could be candles, unscented, ideally beeswax. But then we can get incandescent bulbs. So here in the US, I found a site called 1000bulbs.com, 1000bulbs. And I got light bulbs for like 85 cents and they're incandescents. Wow. And I also believe that, you know, there's going to be legislation that's not banning them anymore, hopefully in the US. Yeah. So hopefully the rest of the world, again, will follow suit, but I'm not sure. So get rid of those really bright, you know, blue LEDs. And get some incandescents in there if you wanted to do, you know, red or orange one. If, you know, even if you have those like smart bulbs, I do recommend getting rid of anything smart in your house if you can. But if that's where you're starting, that's a great place.
Yeah.
I do recommend investing in a really good pair of orange blue blocker glasses. So nicely donned by you at the moment. And using different software to change your screens. So I use Iris Tech software. So on my computer right now, it's not bright blue. It's very amber. Like it's very amber. So it's still daytime here. So it's not fully red, but I take out most of the blue. And so you can do that on an iPhone. You can go in settings. You could figure it out. So you can click the power button 3 times. Yep. It turns the screen red. So getting the artificial blue light out of your nighttime environment is going to be really important because that's going to allow you to go to sleep earlier, which will allow you to wake up more closely to sunrise, which is really important to get outside at sunrise, get that light in your eyes. Even if you can only crack a window, that's helpful too. And then I would say start working on that solar callus. So it's, you know, spring is coming up here in the Northern Hemisphere soon. For me, you know, I maintain my tan because I'm outside all the time and UV is 6 here now, but it's, yeah, we're having a cold snap, but it's going to go back to really nice weather soon. But build that solar callus because that's where you're going to get vitamin D. And then I would say, okay, that was my three.
Perfect. Thank you, my darling. And so for people that are in the UK that are listening to this, we get UVB in 15 days.
Yay.
15 days we get UVB. Now, it does mean our index.
You guys are so north. I need to look.
We are very north.
What latitude you're at compared to
like a Maine? Yeah, we're 52nd latitude. So, well, depending on where in the UK you are, but I'm 52nd latitude in the kind of like lower middle south. But just because we're going to be getting UVB doesn't mean that we're going to be getting any vitamin D because our UV at that time of year is probably going to be about like a 2. So we won't be producing vitamin D. But UVB being there means that there is going to start being some heat generated, which is lovely. And you did mention one thing about cracking a window. And I just want to expand on that ever so slightly. So I get this a lot from people. They're like, oh, you know, I can't go outside all the time. No, I get that. You know, I can't go outside all the time. I work. So what do I do? I crack open a window. And why is that important? Well, because windows block all the beneficial red frequencies. They basically just isolate blue. And so blue light's just going to come through your window the whole time. Everybody's seen that picture of the trucker who's got like aged deformed face on this side. Beautiful. Knocking my blue glasses off. Nice, beautiful skin on this side, aged on this side. Well, that's because they had the window up and UVB, blue light was just hitting that side of the face. So that's one reason to open the window because you need to let those lights in. But the other reason why is because light acts like a photon or as a wave. So if you imagine that your room that you're in is a fishbowl, and this is what Carrie Bennett says, and outside your window is another fishbowl full of water, but your fishbowl doesn't have any water in it, and you crack open that window, the water will pour in as a wave. That's what light does. So you only have to open it. I'll use a British word here. You've only got to open it a smidge.
And I love the word smidge. We use that
smidge,
word.
Beautiful. Yeah. So you've only got to open it a smidge and it will let it in. So if you're afraid of the cold, just open it a smidge. I had this conversation with my mom over the weekend when I went to see her. I was like, Mom, that window should be open. That window should be open. So I just opened up a little bit. So let the light in a little bit because I'm just teaching them all about red light and things like that. But that's why it's important. If you are sat in an office, please open a window. Please, because it's going to make so much difference. One, you're going to get fresh air, but two, you're going to get light. And that is so, so critical for timing. And that's probably the underlying piece of this entire conversation is timing matters to everything in our body, because we haven't just got one clock, which is we've got one master clock, the superchiasmatic nucleus, but our cells all have clocks. Our microbiome has clocks. Everything, our organs have clocks, because everything has to happen in a specific order. This is why they say going to bed 1 hour before midnight is worth 3 to 4 hours sleeping after midnight, because of the fact that you are actually going to start getting growth hormone release, lymphatic drainage, deep sleep cycles to regenerate muscles and hormones. You're going to get all of that if you go to bed at 11 rather than at 1.
Yeah.
Right? Go to bed earlier because it's going to make all the difference. Timing matters, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
So on that bombshell, Danny, please tell people where they can find you and what it is that you're currently offering as your service to people.
Yeah. Thank you. So I hang out a lot on Instagram and make a lot of posts about all this stuff, so it's easier to understand. And so my handle is Danielle Hamilton Health, and I have a podcast, Light Up Your Metabolism. And I have a bunch of programs. So my Blood Sugar Mastery course is my main course for, it's sort of like a VIP coaching experience. I do work with people one-on-one, and I'm currently working on a course that I'm super excited about. It's called the Circadian Method. And that's going to be how to really, you know, optimize and align and sync your circadian rhythm with nature. Because as Mark said, that timing is really everything, and it's really overlooked, and it just causes so many issues, because as humans, we are designed to work with this 24-hour clock because we live on a planet with a 24-hour day. If we lived on Neptune, it would be 17 hours or something. Mm-hmm. So the 24 hours is because of this planet we live on and its lovely tilt. We get all these seasons and changes. But being synced to nature is really important. I like to say, think about a restaurant that's, let's say, open 7 to 5. And this restaurant, all of a sudden people show up, like giant groups of people show up at like 5 p.m. right when the restaurant was closing. All of a sudden we have to reopen and we're out of some stuff and we didn't get a chance to clean all the floors because these people are coming in and all the orders for tomorrow don't get put in. The wait staff is overworked. There's mistakes. The kitchen is forgetting things. And then the next day, the workers are so exhausted because they were in so late. So they show up late. So it ruins the shift for the next group. And so that's what's happening in our body, that it's like things are happening out of order. Stuff is getting skipped, especially a lot of those things in the evening, like all of the repair processes that our body needs to go through that you were just talking about. That gets skipped. And then our body is just where it's like chaos and it's stressful and it's missing things. And so it's not functioning at its best. And so that's why, I'm making that course.
Incredible. So ladies and gentlemen, what I'll be doing in the description below, I'll be adding all the links to the things that Dani has just mentioned so you can find her very, very easily. And I'm definitely going to link up your podcast because you had an amazing guest on your podcast not long ago. Yeah, I listened to that one. He looked very similar to me. So I'd recommend everybody listen to that one.
That was a great episode.
It was such a great episode. It really, really was. And I actually had loads of people reach out to me after that one saying, I saw you on Dani's podcast. It was really, really good. You really touched me with your story. So I know we're going to get the same response from yours coming into mine, my darling. So thank you so much for your time. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Danielle Dani Hamilton. And please like, share, subscribe. Please pop your comments down below. Let us know what you think. If you have any questions, for Dani specifically, I will forward them on to her. And then maybe we can get her come back on for number 2. So please, ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together for Dani, Danielle Hamilton. And I will see you in the next one. Dani, thank you so much, my darling.
Thank you.
Stay blessed.